One. All right, and now we're live. I'm just going to do a quick little intro, and we'll get going. What's up, everybody? My name is Caleb Enfield, and I'm the host of Nomadcast. That's what you're listening to right now. And today I have a super cool guest. Her name is Christina Haswood, and she's running for the District 10 Kansas House of Representatives spot. And I'm super happy to have her. I'm really excited. It's my first political guest. And she is going to go ahead and introduce herself, much like a lot of my other guests have, and you'll see why.
Hello, my name is Christina Haswood. I'm originally from Topeka, Arizona, which is Inscription House, Arizona. But I was born and raised here in Lawrence, Kansas. I'm Bitterwater born for the Black Sheep people. My maternal grandparents are of the Zuni Edgewater. My paternal grandparents are of the Towering House Clan. This is who I am as a young Navajo woman. I am a candidate for the Kansas House of Representatives in District 10. If elected, I'd be just Kansas's third Native American in the state legislature. So we are making history in the making. And my district covers the southeast of Douglas County. Oh. Includes Lawrence, Kansas, and Baldwin City, Kansas. And we have about 20,000 people in my population. We have two universities. We have Haskalani Nations University, which is an all Native American tribal college university. And we have Baker University. And then just right next over into Lawrence, we have the University of Kansas. And this is pretty much who I am. I currently in the primary, had a three-way Democratic primary. I won by 70% of the votes. And I'm currently running unopposed in the general. And right now we're just building community connections and making sure we get out the vote, the message to vote, Indigenous votes as well, and just involve as much of the community as possible.
Nice. So running unopposed, how does that work? Is there a chance that somebody can fill that spot, or is that just going to be unopposed for forever now?
I can do what's called a write-in campaign. Okay. And in Kansas, we had a filing deadline of June 1st, and no Republican filed or Libertarian. So if somebody from other party or even I think the Democratic Party, if they wanted to, can push a write-in campaign where they would have to campaign really hard for people to make sure that they spell their name right on the ballot. But only my name will show up on the ballot for the Kansas House of Representatives in District 10.
Oh, cool. Okay. So that makes sense. So you said you're originally from Arizona, but you were born and raised in Lawrence. Does that mean that your family's from Arizona? Yeah.
What I mean by that is because we're Diné, our umbilical cords are buried back at our homelands, and mine is where my mom is from and my paternal family is from.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about that? I'm sure it's a little weird, but yeah.
So in Navajo culture, we, you know, when we get our umbilical cord, your family, I think usually your parents or your grandparents, buries that umbilical cord back in the earth. And it's supposed to have the significance of tying you back to where you're originally from, where your ancestors are from. So I always, growing up, born and raised here in Lawrence, Kansas, and all the way down to Inscription House. My father's from Hunter's Point by Window Rock, Arizona, on the reservation. And every time I just grew up doing a road trip all the way down to Arizona. Mm-hmm. It's about a day drive. And I would always call the reservation home. Like, oh, I'm going back home, or, you know, going back to the motherland. Mm-hmm. And it's just, that's a whole nother conversation too, of just growing up with seeing the reservation life. I never knew it was considered poor because, you know, just the rich cultureness, and we would always come in learning about our culture and getting to hang out with our grandparents and the rest of our family was always a good time. It wasn't until like higher education and college where you looked at the statistics and looking at everybody else and seeing how far behind we are and more morbidities and mortalities affect us all. That was a whole nother life changing. But back to the umbilical cord story. yeah, I tend to do this a lot.
Me too.
But I guess mine is buried in our sheep corral. And I guess that kind of symbolizes that they hope when I grow up, I would be a great sheep herder.
Interesting.
Yeah. And you can, depending on the family where they kind of want to bury the umbilical cord, maybe it would be underneath a loom. So maybe the person, he or she, would grow up to be a great Navajo weaver. And that sorts of stuff. So that's the significance of that.
That's super cool. I didn't know that. I've never heard of that. My next question then is, so growing up in a city, especially one so far removed from your ancestral homeland, the Navajo Nation, how did you learn all of this? I mean, obviously you went home. Is that just when you learned, as you were taught by your grandparents when you went back to the res, or there's just a lot of moving parts, you know?
My parents are Navajo.
Okay.
English is their second language. So when they came up here, they met at the Grand Canyon. I guess that was kind of the thing to do after high school. That's like a lot of my family. They find their significant other at the Grand Canyon.
That's super cute.
And then my dad had plans to come to Haskell New Nations University and play basketball and I think do football. Him and my mom did like a long distance thing. And then they ended up having somewhere in between I was made and my mom came up here. And they came up here because they, you know, grew up on the reservation and they didn't, they were not wanting to raise their family with such lack of opportunity and poverty and alcoholism and all that. So they had the opportunity to move out here in Lawrence, Kansas to go to Haskell. And at that time, my dad was at Haskell, I think for about a year and a half. He didn't actually get to finish, but my mom came up and then he started having to provide for his family. And he worked at our local Taco John's and that's where kind of where we started, which was actually in the district of District 10. So
amazing. So you've been here your whole life.
Yeah. And then we would go back to the reservation every summer, even for a week or two or a month, and then come back in the Christmas time for my Che's birthday. That's pretty much how I grew up, was just always connected to my culture. And being Diné, we're always taught our introduction. This is like the first thing that we're always doing. And when I was younger too, I did some powwows when I was in Tiny Tots and all the way into juniors. And I was interested in doing like pageants too, Native American pageants.
Oh, cool.
Powwow princess pageants. So I would always practice my introduction because that's one of the requirements usually in these pageants to do. And then finally in high school, we have here a pretty large Native population because of Haskell, and people tend to settle down and have their kids go to school here. So we actually have a Native American Student Success Service Center within our school district. And then they actually got a pageant for high schoolers and junior highs. And that's when I first got into that.
Interesting. So you've been like competing for stuff your whole life. It's not just spots in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, I guess so.
So what was it like growing up in Lawrence as a Native person? I mean, it's got to be pretty crazy because it's got to be a mix of people, but also it's got to be just, I mean, if it's anything like other big cities with lots of Native people, it's like little reservations everywhere, you know? Is it anything like that or?
Oh, here in Lawrence, it's actually less diverse.
Really?
Just kind of, I think, maybe the map of Haskell and the number of people that do end up staying here, because it's actually quite difficult with the housing costs. I believe Lawrence, Kansas is actually one of the highest places of living. And then with Haskell Nations only offering 4 bachelor programs, they have more associate programs, but when you look at job applications, they're not looking for associate's degrees, they're looking for bachelor's degrees. So I believe there's a lack of that needs to be improved. But growing up here, it was mainly just being the minority of the minority. And when I reflect on it, it's like I personally, and I hear this a lot with other natives that grew up in like Phoenix and all these other bigger cities, is you start to not like your skin color. you ask yourself, why am I not blonde with blue eyes? What you see in the magazines that we read, our standardized of beauty doesn't match societal European beauty. And for a long time, I did not want to wear my turquoise jewelry at school. And even when you graduate like elementary or middle school, those type of promotions, it's usually a proud moment where you, you know, put your hair in a Navajo bun, a tie, and then you put on your moccasins and your outfit and you put on your jewelry and you walk on to your journey proud. I was always kind of embarrassed of, you know, being the only native and, you know, having that similar scenario when you're in history class and the native chapter comes up in the history book and everyone starts looking at you. And, you know, I did powwows too, and people would ask me, you know, just having the native questions, but also just trying to educate people that I'm Navajo, I'm one tribe, and there's over 500 tribes, federally recognized tribes, and that's, you know, it was just a weird dynamic. But I believe the turning point of where I started to take more control of my culture and being indigenous and being Diné is really at the end of high school and into college, where I found my passion of wanting to be in the healthcare profession. I started off wanting to be a nurse. And that just comes from in high school when I took an anatomy class and we had to dissect a cat. And we had to skin the cat. And all the kids were like, ew! I was like, oh, this is like butchering a sheep. Like, you don't, you'll never butcher the sheep because that's what we do.
So, you actually skinned a cat?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so it was like no problem for me. And even my partner was like a big football guy. He was like,
uh-uh. Oh my gosh.
That's
too much for me. Yes. I mean, I butchered a cow one time for my sister's sunrise dance here on the res, but it was, I mean, I couldn't do anything like that again, I don't think. I think it ruined hunting for me too.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, we see butchers when we're growing up and we don't really think much about it. And then I guess it's kind of weird, but that's just the way of life for us. And
yeah, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, and I always grew up like wanting to be Miss Navajo, and you know, during the Miss Navajo pageant, you have to butcher. So I always like felt this responsibility of I need to learn this to pass it down. And I have a younger brother, and he wasn't as interested in the culture aspects. So it's like another more responsibility of, you know, when he has his family, they're gonna come to me and ask me about more of the culture. I feel like that's a lot of just like being a woman of color, that's the firstborn, all this type of responsibility to hold on the cultural knowledge. But yeah, during high school, when I saw that I could handle the ins and outs of anatomy, I went to observe surgery. My anatomy teacher thought that I was good to go to a local hospital and observe surgery. And I scrubbed up and everything, and I was like, this is really cool. And then I was like, I think this is something I want to do. And then I watched Grey's Anatomy and I binged it, and I was like, this does not look fun. Like, they're just stressed all the time. And
yeah, one of my friends who's a doctor, he tells me that that show is like the least accurate. You're not in like procedures that often, and there's like a lot of times where you're just talking with people and being boring, and it's like it's not all action all the time.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Yeah, I took that as like, this is not really for me. Then what solidified that decision is when I went back, I was at an internship that summer in DC with Indian Health Services headquarters. And that next summer, that next fall, when I went back to Haskell, I took an anatomy class, and learning, memorizing the muscles and the bones was not fun for me. I was like, if this is not fun now, then it won't be fun when I get into nursing school or if I want to go to med school. So like, I got to do something else. So what at Haskell I did was community health. And I got associates of science in community health, and just learning the process of, I think
a lot of community health mean.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and that's I've interpreted the way of like a lot of our Native communities is we all sit like in a class and teaching like healthy eating.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, I feel like that's just like a familiar format
okay.
with us Natives. So that's how I took it. Like one of the first classes at Haskell was like diabetes in Native American, and one of the first questions that the instructor asked is, "How many of you guys have been affected, have known somebody, or did know somebody that was affected by diabetes?" Mm-hmm. And the entire class raised their hand. There was probably about 20, 25 other Native students in the class. And that was one of the realizations in my life that I realized, you know, I'm not alone in this anymore. Growing up in Lawrence and being like the only Native in your classrooms and being one of maybe 20 in the whole high school, and you know, really being in your culture.
That's super tough.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, I'm finally around people that kind of understand what we're going through. But then it just put into perspective that we all came from different areas of the country.
Yeah, of course. How long did that period last where you were kind of not the most proud to be Diné? Or maybe not pride. I don't know how to put it because it's mm-hmm. it's a very strange situation.
Yeah. I'm sure if you talk to other kids who grew up in the city, they have similar stories too.
Interesting.
About this. But I would say just like being young and just like my mom making fire bread. And you know, when you make fire bread, like you have to open all the windows and uh-huh. your clothes start to smell like grease. And
it's the good days.
Yeah. Well, at that time we lived in an apartment. So like my other, and that's when we lived on like Section 8 housing assistance.
Mm-hmm,
and sure. So all the other young kids that I would play with, they'd be like, "Oh, what's that smell?" I'm like, "Oh, Christina's making fire bread." I was like, "Me?" And then, I mean, it wasn't bad. Like, I didn't get teased. Sure. Like, other cultures will get teased for their food. But it was just kind of like, it made me different. And I didn't like, at that time, being different. You know, at that age, you just want to fit in.
Yeah, that makes so, sense.
Yeah, and then, yeah.
How long did that last for, though?
I would say until about high school, maybe about senior year when I started to do that Native American pageant in high school.
Okay, amazing.
And then just that world of Native pageants is something that I always had my eye on, and wanting to do powwow princess pageants. I wasn't from there's Kansas has 4 federally recognized tribes, and mm-hmm. the powwows that we would go to, I'm not any of those tribes.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't make sense for me to run, or I couldn't run at all. So I always had my eye on like Miss Navajo pageant when I was old enough, or like Miss Indian World at Gathering of Nations. And then just seeing these women as role models.
That's amazing. Did you ever try for any of those? Did you ever compete or participate?
I tried for Miss Haskell and I got second runner up. And then I tried.
Oh, amazing.
And then I went and transferred to Arizona State University for my undergrad. And I ran for Miss Indian ASU, Miss Native American ASU. And I didn't really win at all. I was like last place.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in Phoenix.
Yeah. Like competing with, you know, kids coming straight from the reservation. And it's just, it's just great to be in this type of circle, and it was really uplifting.
So you're 26, right?
Yeah.
What possesses a 26-year-old to do this to themselves, to run for public office like this?
Lot and it's coming from older people saying like, are you crazy? Like,
yeah, exactly.
I was like, I know. I was like, I probably should be. I just graduated grad school. I should definitely.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. First in both sides of my family to graduate from grad school. Now I have one of my little aunties currently finishing up her master's in business. So that's really great just to
incredible
just to break that glass ceiling for my family and start making it the norm.
Yeah, break the cycle.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so people ask me this question, and I think they ask it because normal 26-year-olds are, I guess if we weren't in a pandemic, are going to Europe and going to festivals and doing all those fun stuff. But one of the barriers too with the Kansas legislature, and I think a lot of other government office positions, is the low pay it has. So I think being a Kansas legislature, it's about $20,000 for a year. And the session goes from January to May, which is, you look at the demographics of people who run, they're mostly retired or they're lawyers who have, you know, already that built of wealth. They have married, they have a partner to share the income. They're more, I guess, financially established in that sense. Sure. But that, of course, I believe is a barrier, but that didn't help hold me back because I'm coming from out of school. I'm used to being broke. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
So, last year I made like $9,000 at my graduate research assistant job on campus, the glamorous life of a graduate, a GRA.
So you already had 100% raise. You're winning.
Yeah, and the most, like in grad school, I got a lot of scholarships, which helped me, be more financially stable in comparison to others, which is really great. Proud recipient of Navajo Nation Scholarship and American Indian Graduate Center and American Indian College Fund. Great organizations that helped me out through my educational career and others. Uh-huh. But I think just how I started, I've always been interested. So when I found out I didn't want to be a nurse, didn't want to go to grad school, I found public health more into when I went to Arizona State after I graduated high school. And I've done about 9 or 10 internships in my entire higher education career. It took me 6 years to finish undergrad, 2 years for grad school. In that time, I did a lot of internships at all levels of government too with health. They've all been with Native health, Indigenous health, politically correct American Indian, Alaska Native health.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that at the local level of like Maricopa County in Phoenix, Arizona. I've done it at Arizona State University working with their suicides. I've done it at Navajo Nation Epidemiology Center, Indian Health Services in Rockville, Maryland, the headquarters. I've interned last summer for National Council of Urban Indian Health, which is a national nonprofit, mm-hmm. trying to bridge the gap from when we make Native policies in health, it's always towards the reservation. But once we leave our reservation, pretty much those treaty rights just kind of disappear. So kind of bridging that gap, because 70% of Natives live in urban areas, especially when you're talking about college, Natives coming off the reservation to go to college too. So getting into this health policy field, I pretty much got involved more heavily about a year and a half ago, when I meet with elected leaders or when I meet with Congress and their staffers, or when I meet with the congressmen and women in DC, you get about 30 minutes with these elected officials. And the first 15 minutes, it's like every single time you have to give a Native American lesson, going back to 1492 with first contact. And it's extremely, I would say, disappointing, because we have people, making these important decisions for us, and we're still stuck at this educational level with Native health and learning about tribal sovereignty and, tribal law with the Supreme Court. And I was trying to, when you get into more of local level government, I know everyone wants to be more involved with the president and Congress, but local level government impacts your life day to day. If they approve something last night, you're going to see the change more than if Congress approves something, like with our stimulus paychecks packages, it's taking months and months, especially with the CARES Act. So, when I would go to my local elected officials, I was most of the time the only woman, the only young person there, the only Native American, and then the only Native American young person there. And that list can keep going on and on. And that just showed me that these policies, because I grew up, you know, in Section 8 housing funding, on WIC, on tribal clothing programs, reduced lunch, these type of social programs are supposed to help us. You know, I grew up with my higher education journey with scholarships. And I see these people that are in these elected official positions that don't really have that type of background, or maybe they did, but they're, you know, 60 or 70 years old. It's been a while. And yeah, that was just one of the main motivations of lack of representation. I believe these policies and important decisions that we're making affect people that were like me. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty much, you know, still in this area of, you know, I'm technically below the poverty line. You know, I'm still part of this group.
Sure. That makes sense. So, so a lot of Native people live off the reservation in urban areas. The next natural question is, where do we go then? What's next? What happens? How do we fix these problems that we're seeing? I mean, if you have any ideas, because.
Yeah, that is the question.
Yeah, right? It's tough.
Comes from all levels of people. And I think us Indigenous peoples really got the groundwork foundation of protesting, such as, you know, No Dapple, with the Indigenous missing, murdered women and missing, murdered Indigenous women and peoples, protesting and movements. Here in Lawrence, we're pretty vocal with our injustices, social injustices here. We had like a Black Lives Matter march down one of our downtown streets, as well as sit-in protesting for that seem to show injustices to African-American Black males that are currently in our jail systems. Mm-hmm. So, the city is really strong and progressive in that sense. And I think that's another way of a solution to change. But another solution to change is policy, getting in these positions of power.
Sure.
That have been so long.
Excuse me, I didn't hear that. You cut out for a second.
Words that have been suppressing us for so long.
Okay.
So, like, the federal government is definitely one that we need more representation of. And we see a lot of Native candidates across the country, from Alaska to all the way down to New Mexico here in Kansas, running to be congressional Senate and congressional representative. You know, we were just citizens in 1924. That's not even 100 years ago.
Nope, and it's not even.
We all got the chance. That was supposed to be, you know, our right to vote, but each state made sure that they would make it difficult for Natives to not vote. So I believe Congresswoman Deb Haaland, in her speech last night with the DNC, said that it wasn't until 1962 in New Mexico that Natives were allowed to vote. So that's, you know, about 40, less than 50 years ago, would I say?
Quick math. Yeah, quick math.
So that just really goes to show. 56 years ago?
50-something.
Thank you. That just really goes to show, and my story reflects that too, where I did not cast my first vote until 2016, when it was Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And I grew up in a household that wasn't politically active. I don't have family members that are on tribal council, nor do my family, we don't really like volunteer, or my parents are not on some type of board in our community. We just like to be to ourselves, which a lot of Native families like to do, especially I believe here in the city, we just kind of stay to ourselves and don't try to be too loud and make too much trouble.
Sure.
And really matter.
Oh, it seemed like you got cut out. I'm sorry. Something happened.
I guess just voter suppression tactics. And in my family, like, one vote doesn't matter. Your voice doesn't matter, you know, in these elections. It was kind of what I was taught growing up. But then finally, you know, when that election came and we could had the opportunity to elect our first female president, that was something I couldn't sit back on. And that's when I started to really educate, get interested in politics. And, you know, there was another question of why did I not vote when I turned 18? I was at Haskell at the time, and there was no voter registration drive or people on campus to say, hey, did you register to vote? Are there's no, you know, Native Democrats, Native Republicans. So it just, I don't think much has, I hope much has changed, but I don't see much having changed before, because I know Haskell just got their first voter drive event this year.
Well, it's tough because right now, especially right now, it's, I think it's important to be politically activated. I think it's important to be informed. And I think that more than ever, more people are politically active, and they're just doing it in different ways, such as protesting and things like that, like you said, because those are all political actions. But we need to find a way to translate that from people protesting to people voting, because unfortunately, protesting has a limit. You know, your real power comes from your vote, and there's a disconnect. And I agree with you, because when I was growing up, I mean, I voted as soon as I could, just because, you know, I'm an idealist. But I truly felt, and to a degree, I still feel that my vote doesn't matter as much, that due to things like electoral college or just voter suppression or things like that, it's just really tough for me to feel like my vote matters. But I still do it because I know that I have to be a part of that solution, you know. It's really tough. It's a really strange position to be in.
You know, I'm curious to know, like, how you felt that sense of urgency. Maybe Native kids or younger kids don't feel that. They're just, you know, seeing everything on social media and what the media is saying. I don't know. There's not much, I would say, support, would you say, of get out to vote.
Yeah, well, So the problem is there's not the resources, obviously, to help people engage politically here on the reservation. There's not, like, to be able to be informed, especially today with how fast news travels, you have to have internet access, you have to have access to TV, potentially newspapers, things like that, to be able to be up to date with all the stories, you know. And that's just not that realistic for a reservation. It's just the infrastructure here is weak. I mean, even running this podcast where I just record voices is cumbersome on my home internet, you know? So I know that that's a big issue. And also just the apathy that is felt in general from most people. We have to find a way to get people passionate about things that are outside of themselves. And it's, I don't know. That's why I was asking you these questions, because I don't know. I know as much as the next chimpanzee, you know. That's
more people why they feel like they didn't vote, and have a conversation with that. I feel like maybe that's the most common answer, that my vote doesn't matter. And then going from there.
I have a bunch of friends this year, non-Native friends, they're people that I talk to online, that this is going to be their first year voting, and one of them's 30 years old. And he says the only reason he's voting is the same reasons that I vote, is because he wants to feel like he's not part of the problem, you know, at this point. But he just says that he just doesn't feel like it matters. It's gonna, you know, he just feels like what's gonna happen is gonna happen. And breaking that cycle, breaking that mindset is so difficult, because it's really hard to feel powerful when you've been so disenfranchised for so long.
I definitely understand that. And I think that's why representation matters.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know,
when I saw Representative Deb Holland and Representative Sharice Davids win their seat, it really put into my perspective, because I was working in health policy and, you know, I'm trying to be an advocate out there. And I'm always like, why do they not know our history? And then, okay, maybe we need someone to get in there. Okay, let's find somebody who knows our history. But it never really came across my mind that, why don't we get one of us in there?
Yeah.
That know us. And then when I saw that happen and witnessed it in my home state, I always thought that Natives wouldn't be welcome in politics in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking at people who sent me, they don't look like me at all.
Sure.
And, you know, you don't see them at Haskell or getting in touch with the Native community. Even though I've tried with my representative, well, Senator Jerry Moran for Kansas is on the Senate for American Indian Affairs.
Okay.
Pushing. Uh-oh. Oh.
It cut out for a second.
That's okay. I think he could do better. And then with my Congress man, I tried to meet with him and, you know, he lost his primary. So we're really pushing on the Democratic side because she, Michelle De La Isla, the mayor for Topeka, that's running for the Congressional District 2, where I live in and Haskell is and all four tribes live in. She, you know, has attempted to learn our history and find ways. I believe she already met with some tribal leaders as well here in Kansas, which is really great progress. But, you know, going back to the question, how can create more change? I think, you know, we covered protesting, we covered getting in politics, but there's also change within research. If that's your niche or, you know, in IT, creating more change. I think just standing up in places where our voices aren't normally are, and, you know, just not being afraid. And most of the time, if you're the only Native in the room, no one's gonna, you know, say like, oh, what you said was wrong. Or, you know, we always kind of had this joke like, oh my God, did I just say that Navajo word wrong? They're like, no one hears Navajo. So, you know, everyone's going to believe what you just said. But you just go up there and say it with confidence. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I was here. The other Native legislature, Representative Ponkawi Victors of Wichita, she's been a great mentor to me. And I was just telling her, I was like, I think I messed up my Navajo introduction. She's Tohono O'odham and I think Pima. Mm-hmm. She goes, you know, everyone here is non-Native. They won't know if you messed up your introduction. You go out there and you say your introduction loud and proud because that's what the energy that you're bringing out of.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, that's a whole nother conversation too, of like my self-confidence being 26 in politics.
Yeah, that's, I can imagine. I like people that are older than you, you're supposed to respect them and stuff. And you're just going to go in there and openly argue with them, you know? It's crazy. And I get it.
Our beliefs too, of like respecting our elders.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But I think I like to think I'm different because I'm a really great listener. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the most important thing that people, voters, just want. They want someone to listen. They want someone to hear their issues. A lot of times when I was calling voters, their issues were, you know, beyond my future control as a state legislature, or maybe it was an issue that was more local government, but, you know, I would still listen to their issue. And then when I find, you know, they're talking about, I guess maybe like Donald Trump or something, you know, I'm working in a state, not in Congress.
Yeah,
I would take that and they would tell me their issue and sometimes about the foster care system here in Kansas. And I would make sure to pass that along because those personal stories are extremely important.
Uh-huh.
They carry a lot more, you know, just more on your mind. And I think that's what would really help change policy. But yeah, if you're listening and you want to create change, you can in your own field. You don't have to get into politics like me. Even in the classroom, you know, if you're in higher education or in high school and, you know, in public health at ASU and I'd be in these like 50 plus classrooms and they start talking about the federal government or, you know, policy systems of change. and they bring out the diagram of, okay, here's the United States government. If we're going to create this health policy, I raise my hand and be like, okay, what about tribal government? You know, what does tribal government have in this play? And pretty much 9 out of 10 times, the instructor will say, I don't know. And that puts them more in accountability. And you're bringing that awareness to your peers. I felt that responsibility more in grad school, because everyone here is in grad school and they're wanting to be directors and they want to be, you know, going into PhD programs. When you're at this higher level, you're already wanting to be in leadership positions.
Sure.
You guys need to know this, that tribal government and tribal sovereignty need to be a part of these at the table and at these solutions. You can't just go into communities with your master's degree, your PhD degree, and say, you guys are doing this and this wrong, and then just leave and expect the community to fix it. That's not how we do it. You know, I was trained with, it's called community-based participatory research approach, where you involve the community every step of the way. And that just comes from the history of research with Natives being completely, disgustingly unethical and unmoral. Not only with Natives, but, you know, the Black and African American community and other minority and marginalized communities as well.
I really love listening to you talk about your community. There's a lot of pride there. Why Lawrence? Why did you decide to go back to Lawrence, or stay in Lawrence better, and, you know, do things there? I'm just curious.
Yeah. My entire higher education has been dedicated to the Native American, American Indian health population, and then just pushing that type of research. But I always felt like I haven't given back to the community that raised me, that I was born and raised in. And I wanted to, you know, I found my specialty. Native American public health research and suicide was my research of topic of interest, and mental health. I've narrowed it down, and that's usually the hard part for a lot of people is, okay, I want to get into public health, but I don't know what to do. I already had that narrowed down. I've done that for about the past 8 years.
Sure.
What I wanted to do is take a couple steps back, look at other races, look at other suppressed communities. And I already was making plans to work at my local county health department, or for the state health department as well, just to see, you know, look more into the community that raised me and how are we when I, you know, was first raised. Because looking at the data and then thinking back on those life experiences, it kind of makes sense and makes that connection. And then fast forwarding it to the data of 10 years, 20 years later, and seeing, did we even improve at all? Are these kids, you know, growing up in my community, in my district, still facing the same struggles that I was 20 years ago? And if that's the issue, then we really got to fix things. And this way, how I got involved with my community when I started to see these issues more and take more action within my ability and power is volunteering. And even with the COVID-19 and the pandemic, Kansas was one of the first states in the country to shut down their schools. And that raised the issue of food insecurity and child hunger, where many kids rely on the public schools, lunches and breakfasts as a main source of meal and nutrition of their day.
Sure.
So what my community did is that they created a free lunch program, and we had about 5 or 10 local restaurants take turns every day. And there was probably about 5 different sites with the United Way Foundation as well, and their local commerce, Lawrence Chamber of Commerce. It was a whole team effort, community effort to
provide
lunches. Yeah.
Was that all donated? Oh my gosh.
I believe restaurants donated it, but they got, I can't exactly remember, but it was part of the federal funding.
Yeah. I assume there was something. Yeah.
Yeah. Arizona did it too. And that also raised a lot of issues that, you know, some restaurants or the community was just breaking even or losing profit. in this type, but it branched out to local restaurants, and then it helped our local agricultural and farmers, because they were suffering too. Restaurants are closed. The local farmers couldn't sell their produce at what they produced already at the high capacity. So like we saw in the news, like the milk had to just be drained out. So, and that was really great to see my community come together at a time where unemployment was high, furlough was high. Like we just didn't know what to do. And there was a lot of volunteers. Even the first day I went to go volunteer at one of the middle schools, we had too many volunteers. So it was just great to see us come together like that during these unprecedented times.
That's really great to hear. I'm a really big fan of the giving back to your community. I came back to my reservation and I work here now. I don't know if it's permanent, you know, but I may leave someday, but I'm a big fan of that. Comes from this idea that I heard from, I don't know if you know Killer Mike, he's a rapper. He's one half of Run the Jewels. He has this idea that he's talked about with Roxanne Shanté about re-entrification, right? As kind of the opposition to gentrification. So gentrification, you're getting kicked out. Re-entrification is you go away, you get educated, you come back to your community, you buy land, you open businesses, and you help that community grow. And I'm a big fan of that idea. Obviously, it sounds good on paper. It's really, you know, a romanticized idea. But I think that like people going back home and running for office or even just getting a day job is so important. And I'm so proud of you for doing that. That's really incredible.
Yeah, definitely. You know, any opportunity to give back. And there's actually a couple of grants too for Native communities to maybe give you a couple hundred dollars to start something. I think one of the greatest efforts is coming from younger people and having social media. And even on the Navajo, on my Navajo reservation, you saw GoFundMe pages, multiple GoFundMe pages that for COVID-19 relief, when the tribal government couldn't move fast enough to get COVID-19 relief funding. Whoa. And resources.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. I mean, Tyler Johnson out there, he's this silversmith from Cameron. He's out there like helping elders and getting firewood and doing extra stuff like that. You know, and he's my point of reference because he's someone that I'm personally acquainted with. I don't want to start talking about other stuff, but he's doing this stuff, and it's not like he's getting paid or anything. He's just out there doing it because he can, you know, because he understands that upholding his community is an effort that he has to take because, I mean, I don't know, in 50 years when we're all upset because a reservation was dissolved somewhere, you know, we're going to have to look at ourselves and realize that we could have helped stop this. You know, it's got to come from us. That's the point that I'm trying to make, is we have to make this change. It's really interesting. And I'm really happy to get to talk to you about it because you're so into like that community involvement, that holding your community up. And that's so fascinating to me. That's really cool. Anyway, to kind of pivot into something that your constituents might want to hear about instead of our personal lives, I figured we might talk a little bit about your platform, about how you've gotten people to vote for you. So would you mind talking about a little bit about that if I ask some questions?
So we had a lot of common questions. One of them here is healthcare and COVID-19 response, and how are we going to get the state of Kansas in our district? In my county, Douglas County, we first, and I believe we were in like New York Times magazine saying that, oh, this county is doing great in Kansas. And then here about a week or two ago, we had a really high spike of COVID-19 cases. And we are university towns. So that puts into, there's this big whole conversation of the University of Kansas opening up. And, you know, how's that going to look? Because majority of positive cases are coming from fraternities and sororities. And before that, when the colleges had to stop going to college and in class person
in person instruction,
was the local university bars and, you know, nightlife that were creating these cases. And then right now we can see more of the cases are coming from retirement homes and communities. So I want to create, you know, policy, safe policy. Our government, Governor Kelly, was a great leader, not only for the state, but for the country, implementing these fast, quick public health policy executive like orders to protect our community. And she was utilizing public health expertise and task forces, looking at data. And that's how we have a phase of reopening program for our state. And, you know, maybe if we had too high of cases, Kansas is actually one of the red states too, for travel restrictions. So she has tried to implement a lot of policy, public health policy of mask mandates, but unfortunately, the more conservatives of politics said that she couldn't do that. So then it got left to a lot of local level decisions. One of the big things was the mask mandate, and it'll go from county to county to get voted in. So I really think that we need to be looking at data and making data driven, evidence-based decisions. Sure. If we wait a week or a couple weeks to make these important decisions, that's, you know, so many more people with cases. We've been fortunate enough not to have a large number of deaths, but we cannot take that for granted. And, you know, one death is one too many for me. And that just, you know, goes with Navajo Nation. My family has been personally affected with COVID-19. And we recently had a death too. So thank you. You know, I bring my personal experience and my experience to this. And that's also with education, the topic of education. I am was the only candidate in my primary that was endorsed by the Kansas National Education Association, which I have the support of teachers and some school boards within both Lawrence and Baldwin City. Mm-hmm. And I am extremely proud to have that endorsement and that support and helping them. You know, I was once a student through this education system as well, and making sure that not only do we uphold the equity and quality of education for the state of Kansas. I believe that, you know, there's studies too that show that if you invest your education, your jobs, you know, it create more jobs because people are more qualified with a quality education to do these type of jobs. I saw like research like that, and I thought that was amazing. So me being a product of higher education too, that's one of my things of investing in our education systems and making sure our teachers and our staff have a competitive wage. They do a lot for our community and don't get paid enough for what they do, especially during these times of challenging times, not only for the school system, but for the children and for the parents. It's just, I think teachers have been doing a great job of keeping what they can under control. Work safety environments for them.
Yeah, I agree. I think teachers have been doing great. And I'm going to move to Kansas because I'm a teacher and I'm trying to get paid more. And you're talking about giving me more money. Anyway, so I agree. Responding to COVID, super important, especially in schools. Right now, we don't know what we're doing, to be honest. We're scared. Well, I can't speak for like the whole district. I can speak for myself and like my small corner of it and some of the stuff that I've heard from my like teacher friends. Yeah, they're worried. They're scared. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know how it's going to be. It's a scary time for sure. I don't know. I don't know the answers. You know, it's hard. You're the one with the data and the degrees. So
yeah,
that's why I'm leaving that to you guys. But I agree. I think something needs to be done. I think that we need to keep social distancing. We need to keep, we just need to keep kids safe. You know, I mean, an adult can make decisions on their own. That's their whatever. Kids can't make these decisions. It's really, really difficult to talk about these things because, like, My 10-year-old in the other room, he doesn't have a choice. You know, if school's open, school's open. He's going to school. I mean, well, that's not completely true. I can homeschool him, whatever, but not everyone has that expertise or that access to that. So it's not fair, you know? Mm-hmm. So something needs to happen. I don't know what. It's scary. It's hard. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's weird. It's weird for sure.
It's a tough time, and it only exposed the more issues of, like you said, internet broadband. That's another big issue of Kansas too. All of us working from home, not only mm-hmm. you have households of people working from home, but you have Zoom meetings going on with your kids and their teachers, and maybe you have, you know, a couple more kids. Can your internet bandwidth even support that?
Yep, that's something that we keep thinking about, because I'm work from home right now, and Jesse starts school next week, and I don't know, it's going to be weird, because like his school is going to be 6 hours a day online watching through a computer, right? Mm-hmm. I just don't know how that's gonna, because I mean his need for education supersedes my need to mm-hmm. work. I can do my work at night or whatever, you know, so mm-hmm. that's not that big a deal. The problem comes from just, I don't know, what if there is an emergency at work and I'm not, and I have to be on the internet or something, you know? It's so weird. It's such a strange time to be a parent and to just have worries about school, because mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a teacher and I've been in the school system for, you know, 7-8 years now or something like that. I should have these things down, and I don't know. I'm worried. I don't know what's going to happen. It's weird. It's just super weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. But anyway, are there any, so we talked about your response to COVID. On your website, it says you want to cut food sales tax. Can you talk about that a little bit? That's a very interesting thing to me.
Kansas is one of the highest states that has a high food sales tax, and it's a regressive tax.
Yeah, it says it has the second highest sales tax on food in the country. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that type of tax is, what it means is that communities that are more impoverished or low economic are paying these higher food taxes on, you know, just fresh produce, foods that we need to have. Uh-huh. And that's more impacting them in a negative way than if we look at, you know, my town, Lawrence, on the other side, where there's more doctors and lawyers that live over there. Paying that extra food tax is not going to really hurt their budget.
Yeah, they could throw $30 away in a month, you know? Doesn't matter to them.
We have $30
for me is crazy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you have a Sprouts. Yeah, $30 for me is like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and, you know, on my side of town, we just have like a Kroger and a Walmart, and we're next to an Aldi. So just seeing that dynamic too, is interesting as well. Yeah. And so that type of tax I'm not in favor of. And I believe that we can revisit that and create a more innovative tax system, or we can tax something else to get that funding from. Something that hurts.
Isn't essential.
That's essential. that's hurting hard working Kansas's, you know, pockets. That's not what we're getting at. And there's so much food insecurity too in my district. Like where I live on the east side of Lawrence. In the district, and my nearest grocery store is about 3 miles away. So if I didn't have a car, I would, you know, have to take a whole afternoon. And if you've ever, you know, grocery shopped without a car, it sucks. It sucks.
It's horrible.
You have to get a wagon or something. Yeah. You can't shop for all foods, and you can't really, you know, get frozen foods or anything.
In college, I used to just push the cart home. I used to just
take the milk.
Yeah. And I would walk it back the next day on my way to class.
I wonder if some Haskell kids do that, because the grocery store I'm thinking of is right next to Haskell.
Don't do that, guys. It's bad.
But yeah, there's just that too in my community. So
that's interesting.
Trying to figure out right now with, you know, running unopposed. We're not taking that for granted either. You know, anyone can mm-hmm. come in and do a write-in campaign, but we're really trying to connect with community leaders and the community and voters. Like today we have a like getting or going back to school community talk, and I've invited teachers and school board members on both Baldwin and Lawrence to talk about and kind of have another outlet for parents to ask questions to their teachers and educators, people who make these education decisions, because this is a really scary time for parents and kids.
Yeah, super scary time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that extra security, that extra just confidence in their money could help a lot. I agree. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next one that really interests me on your list, because you have a pretty extensive list. If people really want to get into it, I'll leave a link in the description, but I kind of want to just hit some of them. The next one that really interests me is protect our environment. So you claim that you want to try to have renewable energy resource and achieve 100% clean energy operation by the year 2030. So is that for the state of Kansas or just for your district, or what would that idea be?
Yeah, for the state of Kansas. And
do you think that's possible?
I believe it's possible if we really invest in these sustainable infrastructures. Kansas has a high production of wind, and wind energy grew to almost 42% of Kansas produced electricity last year.
Incredible. And
yeah, so we do have the potential. I believe this Kansas state legislature can do a lot more of improving of our environmental conscious of protecting Mother Earth and making sure that we have this, we have the Earth here for as long as to be healthy for our future generations. And there's a couple of, like, one of the bills, HB 2625, was trying to prohibit local ordinances of dealing with plastic and paper pollutions. Something as, you know, as a community wants to add a couple cents of tax to using plastic bags. You know, I think a community should do that if they want to push that more environmental consciousness into it. And, you know, if we invest more into the wind power energy, we can create more jobs here in the state. And we need someone to build the wind turbines. We need mm-hmm. people to maintain the wind turbines.
Agreed.
And it's
a great opportunity.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm also in the tribes too. We have water rights issues. Those are mainly, I saw, with more the federal government, but I think if we can tackle that more in the local government too, and seeing which of the pollutants are there, is it the pesticides from the crops, or is it other, because I saw a couple years ago, I think it was the Kickapoo Nation of Kansas, they were having some water right issues, and they even at one point advised their tribal nation to not go hunting or fishing. And I was like, if you tell indigenous peoples not to, you know, hunt or fish, so there's a real issue there.
Yeah, they've been living off the boons of the land for their entire existence, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not only that's happening in the north, but I live more in the northeastern side of Kansas, but also in the western side of Kansas. It more, you know, climate change impacts the farmers and agricultures of our state, and it, you know, it brings in billions of dollars into our state too. And we're really proud of that. And, you know, being Navajo too, I've helped my grandparents plant corn and help harvest corn. And we would even, my mom would take us out of school on a Friday to go drive to Arizona to help harvest our corn and our squash. And just having those type of values given to me as a child, I understand that, and I want to help and improve their way of life. They also face their own issues as well, such as I said, broadband, having the control to fix their own tractors and farm equipment. They need these new farm equipments are actually more technological advanced, that they need to be like our phones updated, the program mm-hmm. software systems, and they need Wi-Fi for that. They need internet for that. Yeah. And then if they want to fix their tractors, unfortunately, there's starting to be what I've heard of, like a monopoly of some one company that says, okay, you bought this tractor from us, you can only come back and fix it because we put a code into, mm-hmm. into the software system that we're not going to give you.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff like that happened at the schools mm-hmm. too, where they'll sell you like a printer and only mm-hmm. their people can come work on it because they, yeah, it's so silly. Yeah. Yep. That's insane. Our problems are so different, you know, because that's a farmer and we're teachers, mm-hmm. but they're the same problems. Like they're we're having similar. The same, you know, we're having the same BS happen in our schools as everyone else. It's interesting. Okay. So your next policy that I'm interested in is you say you want to legalize recreational marijuana and that this, I'm going to read this real quick. You want legal recreational marijuana will help block the school to prison pipeline, increase tax revenue to fill the upcoming post COVID budget shortfall and allow farmers more choices of crops to grow. So I think that's super. And it says you also want to release anyone currently imprisoned for its possession.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that's cool. I agree. I think, you bring up a lot of interesting points because not a lot of people are talking about, well, at least not in my experience, are talking about the school to prison pipeline in relation to marijuana, you know, and I like that because I'm a big like 13th Amendment guy where I like talk about it, get on rants about it and how it's wrong. So I appreciate that. That's really cool. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of public health benefits too if we legalize medical marijuana. But you know, why not push it a step further and go recreational? Colorado has done it. You know, a lot of our people. There's a lot of stories of families of you know a young child or someone going through a chronic illness, and they have to go to Colorado and sneak marijuana back into Kansas just to deal with their chronic pain. They want to deal with the pain in a more natural way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's, well, I don't know. I think it's crazy because I shouldn't be able to be arrested for something that someone else can do freely. That's just not fair. It's just not the way it should work at all. Mm-hmm. 100%. It's just morally at this point, it should just be legal because it's legal some places. That doesn't make sense that I can walk across the street into Colorado, smoke weed and then walk back to New Mexico and get arrested for it. It just doesn't make sense. But also, I don't know. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of people who use it for medicine. Like I went through chemo and I know that I definitely used marijuana. And that was just because, I mean, chemo sucks. It sucks less when you're able to use marijuana to like curb the pain. And it wasn't even like I was able to like get high or anything. It was really just dulling pain. Really, you know, making me not nauseous. I wasn't, you know, being crazy with it or anything. It really is a medicine for a lot of people. So I agree with you. I mean, right now I'm not, obviously I'm not sick anymore, but just, I agree. I think that it's silly. It's a silly rule. Okay. Anyway, back on track. You said you want to fight for reproductive rights. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Let me tell you about that. Kansas. Reproductive always attacked in the state legislature. And I believe that just comes from more of a conservative value that Kansas is more known for.
I'm sorry you have to deal with that, by the way. It's not fair.
But, you know, us, I like to say us with a uterus, just in mm-hmm. respect for those who are transitioning, or non-gender binary. If you have a uterus, you're attacked by all these policies, and mm-hmm. we can make these decisions on our own, on our own body. We don't need the government telling us. And this comes from a more personal experience and perspective. I get my contraception from Indian Health Services here in Lawrence, and mm-hmm. when I was going to school at Arizona State. I had them mail it to me and they started adding a multivitamin in with my contraception. And I thought at first it was just a mistake. I didn't request a multivitamin or did we ever talk about this with my provider? But then it kept happening each refill. And then finally, when I had to go back for my annual, I was like asking the gynecologist, why are we throwing in a multivitamin? I was, you know, we didn't talk about this. I didn't okay this. She goes, oh, it's just because you're at the age of, you know, reproduction of bringing in a child and we want your body ready. I was like, wait, who said that I was ready to bring in a child into this world?
Interesting.
I was like, a small story of getting my reproductive rights violated. But having, you know, Indian Health Services run by the federal government, and the federal government telling me that this was probably when I was like 22, saying that you're 22 and you're at the your body's at the age to produce.
Yeah, and your childbearing age, yeah.
Yeah. And having that decision made for me, that was just completely unacceptable. And I was like, no, I don't need it. And
I'm sorry to laugh. I can't imagine. Oh my
God.
Isn't
that crazy?
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? That's insane. And, you know, that's fortunately just, you know, a minor story and what other people have to face through with their reproductive rights being violated. And, you know, we can make that decision on our own.
Yeah, that's kind of why I didn't like even read the poll, because this is your guys' conversation. I care, you know, as much as the next guy cares, because I want my girlfriend to have all her rights and stuff, but I'm only going to advocate as far as she'll let me, you know what I mean, kind of thing. This isn't my space to be taking up space, so thank you for sharing that story. That's really incredible.
Yeah, with the issue of I think the argument is abortion rates. Oh, yeah. That's, you know, putting a policy saying that you can't have abortion, and it's actually been going through the Kansas State Supreme Court saying that abortion is, you know, a right of a Kansan, and they're trying to take that away. That's not the way to fix the abortion high rate issue. You go back to the local levels and do like sex education, reproductive education. And, you know, if one community is being affected, maybe it's a low income community in Kansas, then you just, you know, bridge the gap and make that education system more accessible.
Yeah. Or you help that community to be better, to be stronger all the way around, so that those people maybe will just want to have those children. Maybe they'll have the confidence, the financial stability, you know, because that's a lot of things that it's so frustrating that people aren't, all they're seeing is like, oh, we're aborting babies. No, these are part of much bigger problems. You know, this is just one small symptom of what we've wrought as a society. It's insane that people are blaming so many things on like stuff like abortions or marijuana or, you know, or energy. Like, no, these are all just small symptoms of a system that we've built to not let people succeed. It's, I don't know.
Tackling the issue, if you're trying to make a ban on something, you have to go upstream.
Yeah, exactly. It's so stupid. But anyway, the last thing I want to talk about from your policies, and I save this for last because it's the hot button one, the reform policing systems. Christina will fight to end qualified immunity, require liability insurance for police officers to price bad cops out of a job, and extend whistleblower protections to ensure that good cops who report abuses of power are not retaliated against. Okay. Can you explain qualified immunity? I've read about it a little bit, but I don't want to sound like an idiot. Could you explain that a little bit for me?
That's okay. Just like the simple definition we have is the presumption of good faith allows bad cops to become repeated offenders.
Oh, so like you just assume they're in the right because they're okay. That makes sense. That's what I had. That's how I understood too. Okay.
Which comes from the Black Lives Matter movement and the involvement it's been having here in my local community. Oh, and then we had a sheriff's race too, and they did a forum with our native population here because we just recently had an Indigenous voting Facebook group. That's being more active and getting us Native Indigenous peoples involved, and they had
congratulations.
Forum. Yeah, thanks. I didn't have much involved with it, but
just the community coming up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The water rises, all the ships go up. It's amazing.
Definitely. And they had a forum with the sheriffs, and there was a three-way Democratic with a primary with them too. And the issue came up of missing murdered Indigenous women, and they all said, I was not aware of that. I was just like, yeah, it just showed how much work needs to be done. I was like, you know, in February, Representative Ponkawee Victors was introducing a missing murdered Indigenous women's bill in the Kansas legislature. And, you know, that's when I kind of got involved more into Kansas local politics. And I asked her if she needed help on expanding it to urban areas. But then seeing that of our local sheriff government, because Kansas is in the middle of the country, no doubtably a pathway to trafficking and of humans and all other illegal things. But they didn't know something that's, you know, I feel like a lot of people, non-natives, are educating themselves on that was an issue. And they also, we don't have a native community center, but they were referring to Haskell as like the point of contact as the native community center.
That's not Haskell's job. Yeah, it's not Haskell's job, you know?
I was like, no, 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 no. So the winner of that primary, I wrote him a message. I was like, we need to talk.
Yeah, we need to figure out how to get a... Interesting.
Yeah, so I'm ready to work with them too.
Yeah, of course, you have to be.
Local community, yeah.
Okay, so end qualified immunity. I think that's a good idea, you know, innocent until proven guilty or whatever, but like you're still a citizen, you're still a person, you should still have to answer the same laws. Agreed. Require liability insurance for police officers to price bad cops out of a job. What does that mean?
Yeah. It's called malpractice insurance for police.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And it would, you know, violent cops will be priced out of a job, making it
Does that mean when they have like an incident, they'll have to pay like a higher premium or whatever for their insurance that they have? Or how does that?
Through the court system. I believe that's pretty much what it says, and making sure that there's more accountability on cops, you know, doing bad practices and, you know, not holding them above the law, but
mm-hmm.
because they're sworn to protect our community, they need to be held accountable to that when they do something bad. And then another one of my policies is to expand whistleblower protections. So other people in the industry feel like it's safe enough to report bad practices that they see. And, you know, we saw that most, you know, with the murder of George Floyd.
Sure.
I'm seeing 3-4 cops witnessing a bad practice and of a policeman, and you know, no one was stopping to intervene.
Yeah.
I think we really need to start holding them accountable, and working to build that relationship back into trust, as well as investing in our social programs. If they do start to get more population gets more incarcerated. We have to look at the data and look at how can we help this population. What another issue with my community is that when I was trying to look at the data of the jail population, the last annual report, at least available to the public, was in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago. And, you know, there's no report on how COVID-19 has affected the jail population. That's one of the big topics, too, in my community. And our sheriffs and our district attorney races were more talked about and more held accountable for good reason, too.
Uh-huh.
These are very important topics. And then we have a community that has a loud voice and making sure that we create change to this.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of police are such an interesting thing to talk about because they're so necessary sometimes. But in their current iteration, they're so weird. They're so misused. It's, I don't know. Like I said, that's why you're here. That's why you're making these decisions.
We need to just, you know, create that public relationship back and transparency.
Mm-hmm.
I see, you know, with issues of trying to keep police more accountable, what happened in my community too is we have a Facebook police scanner page.
Interesting.
That someone... volunteers their time and to listen to the police scanner, and they post, you know, what's happening in our community. Stuff? They don't record it. They just like create a Facebook post.
Oh, like it. Report it onto there though? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Facebook. But I guess there was an issue of people showing up to these like crime scenes or accident scenes and getting out their camera, and I don't think that might have been the best action from the community.
Uh-huh.
So helping people, you know, especially with a social justice issue like Black Lives Matter, you know, we're not from this community, and we need to ask this community, you know, what's the best way that we can be a solution into this very important issue, you know, and also talk to the other organizations like the police department and the sheriff's department and district attorney's office that are either contributing in, but can also be a solution to these issues as well.
Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy, but something does need to happen. I mean, these things are still happening. Yesterday in Arizona, it might've been 2 days ago now, police officers held a man onto the pavement in Phoenix and he died. And they think he died because of the heat, because it was 180 degree pavement, you know? Because in Phoenix, you know, and it's just like, why are these things happening? Why is this an issue? You know, so I'm all for it. I think there needs to be something needs to happen. There's a lot of ideas out there. Smart people will put them together in a way that makes sense. Hopefully, you know, hopefully we don't jump back into a system that continues to disenfranchise people, but I don't know. We'll see how it goes. You know, I have faith because we have people like you starting to come out of the woodwork, people that really care, people that want the community to do the best they can. And I think that's powerful.
Pretty much, yeah. Listening at this point, digesting and connecting with communities and organizations to see what we can do to create solutions, because you can create a solution by yourself, but it's not as powerful as, you know, creating a relationship with others to come up with these solutions.
Well, it's the thing is, like, we all live here. Like, everyone in Lawrence lives in Lawrence. They have to deal with whatever you're going to do. So they should all come together and help you do it. They should all come together and make sure that they're getting something that represents their needs. Cause that's what you're there for, is to work for them. You know, you're a public servant. And it's just, I don't know. Anyway, I think we're, coming up pretty close to a cool point to end. So how can people get in contact with you? How can people find your policies, vote for you, all that stuff? Anything that you want to plug or do, any of that kind of stuff, go ahead and do it now.
My name is Christina Haswood. That's H-A-S-W-O-O-D. We do have a campaign website called haswoodforkansas.com, and that's F-O-R-K-A-N-S-A-S.com. We are on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, even TikTok at Haswood, F-O-R-K-S. That's the handle name. And then if you ever want to email me, that's just at Christina@HaswoodForKansas.com. And I am always available through direct messaging. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me. And I would be more than happy to schedule a phone call or a Zoom meeting, and just chat. I would love to listen to your, you know, advice, your concerns, and your potential solutions to our issues. I think this is a great time for us to come together and listen and discuss.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much. Oh, one thing I didn't ask about that I meant to, people, I don't know if people stick around. This is more for me, I guess. How do you get involved? How do you decide to run for politics? Like, do I just walk up one day and just say, hey, my name is Caleb Enfield, I'm going to run for this district because I feel like it, and I'm 20 whatever years old and I'm doing this? Is that it?
I mean, that's not the recommended way to do it. But so, you know, it depends. It's state by state. And, okay, you know, their rules and policies on elections, I believe ours is like Kansas secretary. And it has a lot of these rules and policies of when. Okay, so you need to figure out when the deadline to file is.
So you actually have to like file paperwork and do a thing. And okay.
Yeah. I did is when I decided to file. You can, of course, declare your candidacy, kind of like how, you know, I could say I declare to run for president this year, but you don't go and file yet.
You heard it here first, folks.
No.
Has one for president.
But yeah, so you have to figure out the filing deadline and you got to file before that. And then
okay. For
us, our system was you have to go to Topeka and fill out the form. And there's like a person who like witnesses it. And then you can either petition to file and get, I think it was about 10% of your district's signatures, or you could just pay a fee. And the difference between state to state, because I believe Congresswoman Deb Haaland said that she had to get signatures for New Mexico. But yeah, ours, you can just pay, and that pretty much guarantees your name on the ballot for the primary election. And that's just the, you know, kind of the mechanics of it. But I guess how I got involved, I got a call from our Native American Kansas Democratic Caucus chair. I volunteered for the party for one of their conventions back in February. And my whole plan to get into politics was just to ease into it. And I was going to like my state legislatures. She would have, her name is Representative Eileen Horn. She's a great representative. We are so sad to see that she's going, but she did
she's
endorse
the spot
me.
You're okay. taking, right?
Yeah. She endorsed me.
Okay.
She would have like Saturday morning coffee talks, and I would just go. And that's when I found out like I'm the only Native and the only person of color here talking about Native issues.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
And she's great, but she didn't know much knowledge of Native issues as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard to learn for sure. That's why I, when I do these podcasts, I send out that form thing. Obviously for someone like you, you have a website but I send out that form because there's nowhere to do this research. I need people to tell me what they're working on. You know, it's so I understand why it's hard to learn, but I also don't think there's enough effort. Like you're there, you're a resource. They could pay you to teach people to do these things. You know, they can give you some money and have you teach them how to do this. And they're not. It's lazy.
So when I saw that lack of need, so I got a call back in April, May. It was like 9 p.m. on a Thursday night. I was about to watch Netflix. Like I just got done with my homework. And then it pretty much just like changed my life. And she was saying, hey, we think you would be a great candidate to run, because Representative Horn announced that she wasn't seeking re-election. And you've lived in the district your entire life. We've seen you around in the community. And even when I go to these, you know, these conferences or meetings, I always make a point to ask a question. I mean, the most simplest question you can ask is, what about Native communities? What's your plan for Native communities? Mm-hmm. You can pretty much ask that question to anything. And most of the time, people will be like, I don't know. But they will remember you. Yep, they will remember you asking that question. And I make a point, sometimes I get a little dramatic and stand up and ask the question so people can see me, see, you know, my beautiful, long indigenous hair and brown skin.
That's right. That's right. They got to know. They got to know.
There's that pageant in me.
Get up and do your wave.
That's how it felt sometimes. I was like, where's my crown and my sash? Because I'm about to give you all a history lesson. But yeah, just always, you know, don't be afraid to stand up. And, you know, when they first approached me with that, I got the okay from my family and my circle, my close circle, because not only are you going into politics, you're bringing everybody into the public light.
Sure.
So once we were all okay with it, and I was like, okay, we took about a month of preparation to collect endorsements from my local leader. So I got endorsed by like the Lawrence mayor, Jennifer Ananda. I'm about a good handful of current state legislators, who, you know, which was really great to see, even former governor, Kansas governor Kathleen Sebelius endorsed me. And she's just amazing. And, you know, Congresswoman Deb Haaland endorsed me and has been such a great mentor to me. Representative Ponkawee Victors, the second Native American to be in the Kansas legislature, and she's running for her 8th term. So she's been in there for 10 years and just, you know, kicking butt. And I just get so inspired by these women in politics.
Agreed.
But yeah, we collect endorsements, and it just showed that people were excited for my candidacy. And I had a group of people already there at the state capitol ready for me to help me into this role.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so when okay. When this starts, you said session is from January to May. Does that mean that you'll be like in the state capitol on campus every day, like in sessions, writing whatever's, reading whatever's? So you'll be doing that for that stretch of 5-6 months or whatever it is?
Afterwards, wow. I have to find a job that will allow me to work half the year.
Well, incredible. And I look forward to hearing about it. I really do. I look forward to following this story. When I first saw this reported by Indian Country Today, I was inspired because I don't know. I mean, I know that there's a lot of people doing what you're doing right now, a lot of Native people, which is incredible. But I saw yours and I latched on and I had to have you on and I knew it. And I'm so glad I did because you're so smart and passionate and so beautiful. And it feels so good to have a young person that cares this deeply, because I know the young people that I know don't care. So it's just, you know, and I say young person, I'm about to be 28. I'm not like super old or anything. But it's just, you're a young person to me, you know, no offense or anything, but yeah, no offense. I'm not trying to talk shit or anything, but
no, there's a lot of like young natives, indigenous people that are just, you know, out on the front lines of these issues. Cool, and I was just like, you guys can, you know, do more. And, you know, if you're, you know, like me, like I felt like, you know, I wasn't really much of a protester. And sure. I respect that way of change. I mean, I've gone to a few, but I don't post it on social media or anything, because I don't think that's for me, myself. I don't think that's, you know, the purpose of me being there. But I believe, you know, if we get more people into this political field, not only of state legislature, but you know, maybe school board or your county commissioner or, you know, your tribal government too. I saw a couple of kids I went to high school with, and one of them is his new chairman.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. What?
That's so cool.
I think it was Apache, Oklahoma. I went to high school with him, and we're not like friends or anything.
Oh yeah, for sure.
He probably doesn't remember me because he was a football player and I was like kind of a nerd. But it was just weird. Nerd. but at high school, it just cracked me up because they would always, we're like 18 and 19. They'd be like, you need to, you know, work with each other because you never know who's going to be the next tribal chairman or chairwoman. And, you know, at that age, you're just like you're coming in your sweatpants and hoodie and like, you're just like, sure. But, you know, it's happening now.
Yeah, and they didn't know who they were really talking to, you know? Mm-mm. We got Haswood for president coming up, straight from Haskell.
yeah, but that was pretty much my process to it. And then the campaign was a hard-fought campaign.
Amazing.
And it just opened up to other issues, too, that, you know, about being an indigenous. Was another struggle, too, of how much of my culture do I put into this race, and how much, because I'm not running for a tribal position.
No, that's a very interesting question. That's a very interesting thing to think about in everything that you do. Like with this show, you know, I have the same issues. So I understand completely. And I think you're doing a great job, and I'm really proud to have met you and to know you. Really, I am. This is cool. And I think that you're blazing a trail for even more Native youth to look up to and follow you to do these things. And that's why we're here. And I appreciate you for that. Thank you.
Yeah. Hit me up on social media. I would love to help in any way. Even if you're not running right now, it doesn't have to be right now. You can be like, oh, I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I'd definitely love to sit down and talk.
Yeah. So everyone that was listening, remember to hit her up at Christina4KS on her social media, Christina Forks, Haswood4KS, Haswood Forks. Okay. And then her website is haswoodforkansas.com. I'm only repeating these because we talked for so long afterward. So make sure you go and hit her up, support, contribute if you can. And if you're from the area, talk to her about these issues. Tell her what you're thinking, because that's important. Like we said, everything is all about community involvement. So talk to her, let her know you're available, let her know that you're there to help and to be about it. And anything you want to add, Christina? Any last remarks before I close it out?
Thank you for having me on today. I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, to everyone, and have a wonderful day.
That was adorable. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks everyone for listening. Remember, if you know any native rappers, aerosol artists, street artists, b-boys, b-girls, DJs, anything like that, send me their information, because I am working on a Native American hip hop series on this show. Also, if you know any guests that you'd like to come on, please have them come on. Like and share and all that kind of stuff. We'll see you guys later. Thanks for listening. Bye.